Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of November. Our guests this hour are co-authors of Closed Minds, Politics and Ideology in American University. We discovered this book through an article in the New York Times published early in November. Professors, liberalism contagious? Maybe not. Three sets of researchers recently concluded that professors have virtually no impact on the political views and ideology of their students. One of our guests this hour said if there has been a conspiracy among liberal faculty members to influence students, they've done a pretty bad job. And we're going to be looking at a number of issues during the course of this hour, whether or not ideology has an impact, and we've heard this before the past 20 years or so, that ideology has an impact on hiring and promoting, particularly that would benefit those who have a liberal persuasion rather than a conservative persuasion. How do students view their professors' political beliefs? Do they encounter political bias in the classroom? We're going to be looking at all of this this hour of our program with two of the authors of the book. We'll have two guests with us, Professor Bruce Smith, joining us the first half hour, a visiting professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. And later, Jeffrey Mayer will join us. He is associate professor of the School of Public Policy at George Mason. I have a feeling we're going to get flooded with phone calls on this issue. So call in as early as you would like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org. Professor Bruce Smith, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Professor Smith.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us.
By the way, that's Jeremy, not Jeffrey.
Yes. Oh, did I say Jeffrey? Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know why I said that. Jeremy. Yeah. And Jeremy will be with us a little bit later. All right, let's look at why you decided to study this. You did a pretty exhaustive study of universities, I know. Was it just sort of conversation at the school that had you, or things that you heard among people? Because we've been talking about this for a long time.
I'll tell you the origin of it.
All right.
I've spent the early part of my career at Columbia University. Then I went down to Washington for 1 year, and it turned into 20 years mostly at Brookings. But since my wife always said, oh, you ruined my life moving us down to D.C., it was only fair that she ruined my life to move us back to New York. So we went back to New York in 2000, and I became connected again to Columbia. That was a professor of political science. And 9/11 happened in New York. People we knew had been involved. People at Columbia had been involved. In March of 2003, there was a big brouhaha on campus where one young anthropologist, called for a million Mogadishus to teach these nasty Americans a lesson. This just rocked the campus. 20,000 emails flooded the university president's office. His phones were tied down. They had to relocate this guy in the middle of the night. He had death threats and so on. The next year, there was a big fracas involving a professor in Middle Eastern language who lost his temper, ordered a Jewish student out of the class, said, if you don't accept my view about Israeli atrocities, I don't want you here. So that rocked the campus. So I became interested in this issue sort of viscerally, and having lived through the earlier Columbia student disturbances of 68, I was there. I really wanted to look at this, but coincidentally, not to take too much time, a friend from actually the son of an old colleague called me and said, you know, we really would, these new studies that come out, tremendous new sort of leftism growing up on campus, we'd really like to have this looked at. Do you think this would be a good thing to study? And I chatted with some colleagues, looked into it, and decided I would like to do it. We had some complications. We moved back to D.C., and I hitched up with my old friend at George Mason. Mason, Lee Fritchler, and then later we added Jerry Mayer, who was a younger colleague and good in methodology, helped us with the national survey. So our motivations were all slightly different. And when you, you know, if you have, we've made some joint appearances, and afterward, we were at the Chronicle a couple weeks ago, after one of the editors expressed incredulity that the three of you could ever have collaborated on anything.
Why is that?
He said, you're so different methodologically, ideologically. But that was part of the aim, that if we approach the subject with people holding different political views and tried to study it soberly and seriously, and also different views as to how you would study this. How could you get a hold of this and answer, you know, the question of whether universities are bastions of leftism and bias and so on. So we decided you had to do it broadly, you had to do it historically, you had to do it systematically. We had a national survey. We, you know, employed focus groups of students, detailed interviews, some site visits. So we had a very eclectic methodology kind of pulled together, because I did the principal writing and then the colleagues would comment and criticize, and Jerry Mayer did the chapter on the national survey, which you'll talk about. So it was a kind of diverse motivation. I was mainly interested in kind of intellectual history. Lee was mainly interested in protecting sort of the universities from attack. He's an old college president, was assistant secretary of higher education. Jerry wanted to bring quantitative methods to bear, so we had to compromise and work together and try to blend. And I think our feeling was that if we could achieve results that we could believe in, maybe we could persuade our fellow citizens and our colleagues that we had kind of achieved a balanced view of the subject.
So the overall finding, and we'll talk more specifics here, is you write the myth of politicized universities, the idea that the elite universities are rife with leftist policies or leftist politics, or any politics for that matter, is at odds with the evidence.
Right. That's right. Now, we have to understand the term politics in a special way, and I don't want to take time. I urge the listeners to actually get the book "Closed Minds: Politics and Ideology in American Universities," the Brookings book. You can get it through Amazon. You can get it through Brookings. They'll give you discounts, because we phrase it very carefully. By politics, we don't mean a sort of partisan ranting and whatnot. We really mean sort of a philosophical, a deep understanding of the constitutional order, sort of the history of democratic institutions. And in this sense, we think universities really have failed, because they have kind of abdicated the mission which they had in the 19th century until the emergence of the modern research university, which was essentially kind of a technocratic institution. The old-time colleges used to prepare people for citizenship. That used to be a mission, a legitimate bona fide mission. That's gone from the universities now, because they're all very specialized. They want to be scientists. Even the social scientists want to be scientists. They want to be objective. They want to be very specialized. And they flee from really political discussions for a host of reasons, which we lay out in the book, historical and professional, because somehow, you know, dealing with politics is, most Americans don't like politics. And the same is true of most professors. They steer clear of it.
I can't imagine a life without it.
This election has been a kind of wonderful thing in kind of re-engaging people, connecting them, and in that sense having lived through the problems at Columbia, I know that was such a traumatic event, that is, the student turmoils and upset of the late 60s and early 70s, people don't want to, you know, let loose these monsters again, so steer clear of certain subjects.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. I'm interested in the survey that you did as though of those professors who identified themselves as conservatives. Did they feel that they had been discriminated against in terms of finding jobs, in terms of being able to talk with colleagues about political subjects? They had to censor their views.
No, they didn't. Now, Jerry will give you be able to give you more detailed answers, but we found that, first, the students really weren't exercised. They didn't think that their professors were biased. They'd actually prefer and hope they'd be a little more forthcoming than the students we talked to. And then when we surveyed the professors, to our surprise, even most of the conservative professors, some still, you know, felt there's a certain kind of, I can say this because I'm the conservative on our team, and there's a certain kind of crybaby conservatism out there that, oh, they're always after me. But in our survey, surprisingly, very few conservative professors thought that they were discriminated against in hiring, in tenure, in promotions, or had to in any way self-censor their views. So that just doesn't seem to be happening. So if the students don't think it's there, the professors don't think it's there, and also have a nice chapter on a Pennsylvania study by legislators of their own public college and university system. They didn't find bias. They found that bias was rare. So if we thought that, you know, students, professors, and the legislators who study this didn't find it, it probably wasn't there in a great to any great degree.
What about, is this worthy of studying? Did you study this? And wouldn't this have an influence in the classroom, professors self-identifying as either left or liberal?
You know, we don't really have that detail in the study as to how many professors do that. There seems to be a, just from the comments written on the survey instrument, most professors attempt to disguise their views. They don't, you know, trot them out there, but students still can kind of dope it out. They're not dummies. I mean, they've been used to sniffing out what the hot buttons are that move their parents and adults, and they're not, you know, easily fooled. But professors seem to have different techniques for knowing how to deal with controversial subject matter. Some just don't put their views out there at all. Others say, well, it's more honest to say up front where they're coming from, but then still try to be very fair-minded and draw out the students and not be heavy-handed or directive in the class discussions. Others might say, well, you know, I'll meet you after class, and we'll talk about that in great detail. I think right now we shouldn't use class there. You know, there are different ways to handle this. And there was a nice paper by Robert O'Neill, former president of the University of Virginia. Now, I think he heads the First Amendment Liberties Institute at UVA, and he had some suggestions for college. You know, if a student says X, why, then you answer this. Or if a student raises such and such an issue, well, you might handle it this way, or you might handle it that way. But incidentally, this illustrates our point again, because one of the items, and most of it is very intelligent, thoughtful discussion. He's a very intelligent, thoughtful man. But one of the questions that he's giving advice to, colleagues out there, what if a student says, well, your colleague, Professor so-and-so, has said this. What do you think of that? And O'Neill says, oh, that's an absolute no-no. Don't ever get drawn into commenting on the views of your colleague. That is as bad as, cheating. And I thought, oh, my God. I mean, yes, in some sense, you don't want somebody who's an irascible colleague or who bad-mouths his colleagues. That isn't appropriate. But if you can't comment in a civil fashion about views of other colleagues, well, what do you comment on? I mean, that's an illustration of, oh, we must steer clear of, you know, anything that might stir up a hornet's nest.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our lines are all filled. Our guest this half hour is Professor Bruce Smith. He is the co-author, he's a visiting professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University, co-author of Closed Minds, Politics and Ideology in American Universities. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let us start with Justin from Fond du Lac. Hi, Justin.
How's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to comment. I have long been, since I guess I started college, the resident liberal in most of my classes, and had, the pleasure of most of my professors also being liberal, from what I could tell. And I just finished in 2007 law school at the Michael E. Moritz College of Law. At the Ohio State University, and there was one particular professor I had who just happened to be tenured, so could speak his mind, and he was unabashedly conservative in all of his views. He taught business law, and he would often call on me to sort of give the liberal side of things and then proceed to completely demolish my arguments. And I wanted to make the point that I left the three classes I took from him with definitely a more conservative point of view in terms of executive compensation, securities regulations, things that he was teaching about. And I think that what it comes down to is the fact that he was just a very bright man, and above all professors that I've had, definitely shaped my political viewpoint in those areas. And so I guess the comment that I had was that it depends on the brightness of the professor and their willingness to speak openly about their views. And certainly he wasn't ashamed of criticizing faculty, the dean especially, and some of the other professors.
Deans deserve it all the time. Well, Justin, that's an interesting point, and I'm glad that you made that comment. Kathleen, I think, you know, the quote that the New York Times had from one of my colleagues that, professors have zero influence on students, I think that's a slight overstatement. That really was not in our book, and I urge, you know, people to go to the text, you know, Scalia originalism here. I rib my colleagues. But sure, we hope that education is going to have some influence in helping people. It might, in some cases, deepen views that people already hold. In Justin's case, it gave him a little different perspective, helped contribute to his education. So that's good. I think that's great.
Thanks, Justin. Let's go to Sally from Brush Island, Minnesota. Hi, Sally.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
You know, I'm a gopher, too, Sally. I grew up in Minnesota. I just wanted to lay that out on the table there.
Well, I'm a New York Jet now. That Brett Fault left. So at any rate, I disagree with what your guest is saying very much, because I think most college professors are very liberal. And I'll give you some examples of this. I did grow up in New York, but I lived in Wisconsin quite a few years, and I live in Minnesota now. But Columbia University had those guest speakers come in, and I don't know what you call them. I don't want to say the Minutemen, the men that were trying to
block
the illegal aliens.
Right.
And they got up to speak, and those men were literally almost knocked off the stage. They stormed the stage, and that was terrible that they didn't have enough security. The men couldn't speak. And yet, and I may be mispronouncing his name, but the head of Iran is Mahatma Hinajin, is that his name? He got up to speak. I didn't see anyone storm in the stage. And I did protest that. I did call them up and protest that. Then you also have, I called up the University of Illinois in Chicago.
Sally, could I just, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but could I just tell you what, I couldn't agree with you more on that Minuteman episode that was extremely unfortunate. The university took it very, very seriously. I think I just had returned to D.C. from Columbia, New York. They conducted a thorough investigation. That was despicable. It was reprehensible behavior. They examined the cameras and whatnot. They identified the students. They happened to be Hispanic students who had shoved and pushed this speaker off the stage, and they were given fairly, I don't think it's fair to say that they were just wrapped, and that they were put on probation if any other episode comes up with the three ringleaders of that, they're expelled from school. So the university agreed with you very strongly that that is intolerable behavior, and we won't put up with it.
And thanks very much, Sally, for your call. Jim is next from Mellon.
We drowned out poor Sally from her second question there.
Speakers, let you address the Ahmadinejad speaking, but not allowing people of different political persuasions. What about speakers
on
campus?
Well, that Ahmadinejad was an unfortunate episode because I'm puzzled by that myself. I had come back to D.C., so I wasn't there at the case, but I think a lot of the colleagues were embarrassed that he was invited in the first place, but then in the second place that the university president insulted him. That wasn't really the proper way to handle this. I think let the students tear into him, and they did tear into mm-hmm. him pretty thoroughly. So it wasn't a very kind of decorous, the kind of academic discussion you usually have. It wasn't very civil, but it certainly was a very spirited, vigorous discussion with the students, just lighting into him, but some of the students did applaud him because he made some thoughtful points. He's not my cup of tea, but once you have a guest, you got to allow him to speak his mind and field questions from others.
And we go next to Jim from Mellon. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I'm a graduate of the UW-Madison campus, and I think Madison always is an extremely important example here in the fact that the big universities appear to have defined academic freedom as being only for the left. And I'll give you a notion of what I mean here. When Jean Kirkpatrick, the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan, came to give a speech at the Madison campus, she was literally screamed off the stage, so she didn't have a chance to speak. Now, something similar but less annoying happened to me when I was a student. I was in a political science course for upperclassmen on the Madison campus, and we were talking about the regulation or non-regulation of the media industry, radio, television, etc., and I made the point that I thought that instead of these licenses just being given away for free, that since they were so valuable, they should be auctioned off to the highest bidder, and then that money returned to the taxpayers, you know, so the government could use it. I was hissed by the student body for saying so. And there are numerous other examples. I could go on and on with the professor. The free, so-called free speech movement at Berkeley was very similar. You know, it was freedom of speech only for the left and all other opposing views really to be shouted down.
Professor Smith.
Well, I think you have a good point there, Jim. I think, I don't know the full details of the Jean Kirkpatrick, but there were some other episodes at Smith College and so on. She was her speech was canceled. That's inappropriate. That's very inappropriate. And I think, that's just behavior that shouldn't happen. I think we tried to get some grasp of what the situation was with speakers, but it's harder to do that. So we focused a good bit on the classroom. And I think the classroom situation isn't as bad as I'm sorry you were hissed on that. That it's a perfectly reasonable point. It should have been thoughtfully discussed. And I think your teacher should have been a little more skillful at drawing out the class and really pointing out the inappropriateness of denigrating your comments. That was a poor teacher in my view.
Mm-hmm. Professor Smith, thank you very much for being with us. We're going to go to your colleague now, and we thank you for your time.
All right.
Professor Bruce Smith, visiting professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. He's one of the authors of Closed Minds, Politics and Ideology in American Universities. We're just switching guests, same topic here, so your phone calls will still apply to this half hour of the program. Joining us now is Professor Jeremy Mayer. He's associate professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or an email would be okay for you to send as well. That address is talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. We were mentioning the article in the New York Times. Our guest this half hour was quoted in that piece as saying, when it comes to shaping a young person's political views, it is really hard to change the mind of anyone over the age of 15. We'll talk about that and about the research that he did on faculty and students and the important influences on political beliefs, who is most important in that regard. Professor Mayer, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So I was interested in your comments about you can't really change the mind of anyone over the age of 15. Is that right?
Well, I said it was very difficult. It does happen. People do change their minds on issues like abortion and gay rights. And there is an overall influence that you see in studies of going to college. But as far as, you know, that myth of that one professor that is turning all of his students left-wing, we don't have that kind of power. Students arrive on campus with strong religious and political views. Most of them don't change very much.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about how you did this research on faculty and students. Who did you look at?
Well, we did most of our quantitative work on faculty, and we had a national random sample of faculty members from all kinds of universities. And we asked them some questions like, do you think that your views have hurt your tenure chances in the past or will in the future? Because there's this very ugly charge made against universities that we are discriminating against conservatives in hiring and tenure. And even among very conservative professors, we found that they don't think, they consider it either impossible or highly unlikely that their own views have affected their tenure chances.
Mm-hmm. And what about whether or not they felt that it was okay to talk about what their views are? Are there spirited conversations when professors meet for coffee, or do some of them feel, mainly conservatives, feel that they have to hold their tongue?
Well, in our survey, we found that they don't feel that there's any pressure to keep quiet about their views. Now, it is possible that the academy is eliminating the really loud conservatives who make trouble, but I think more likely the conclusion of our book is that there's a bias towards moderates and that there is some diminishing of very eccentric or very strongly held views of both the far left and the far right. When Bruce, my colleague, was at Harvard, there were very vivid personalities who had administrative roles and took an active role in politics on both the left and the right. And I think in higher education today, we tend to have a bias against someone who's publishing op-eds, who's staying active in the political debate. We want only scholars.
Oh, that makes for a classroom that might be dull, huh?
Yeah, and you know, sometimes it seems like on campuses there's more politics being discussed in the English classes than there is in the political science classes. And I'm not blaming my colleagues in English in a sense, because we conclude that some people in political science are not talking about broad issues of citizenship anymore.
Why?
I think because of the kind of burn from the cultural wars of not only of the late 60s, but also of the 80s, that they don't want to be accused of bias. I mean, there are some professors who have been accused of being biased in the way they talk about racial matters. And so a safer choice for an untenured professor is simply to not talk about race.
And yet it's sort of hard if you are teaching political science to not talk about it and to not, I mean, we vote, many people can become involved in campaigns. Are you saying that those who are teaching then may not be as active in terms of civic responsibility as they need to be to get their students to, at least whatever their political views, participate in the system?
Right. I think that we want to encourage professors and universities to re-engage with politics. And universities are facing such terrible criticism from people like David Horowitz and Ann Coulter that they're twisting young minds, that I think some of them have retreated in the face of this criticism. I think we need to re-engage.
Let's go to phone calls for you now. Our lines have been filled here. Mike from Milwaukee is our first caller for you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen. I wanted to first comment on, I believe, Justin's story about his class at Ohio University.
Mm-hmm.
His law professor, I think, used him to beat him down in front of the class to let everybody know how stupid left-wing politics are. And I think he needs to engage in a class where the professor is equally as bright from the left to hear the opposing point of view rather than walk away and let him be used as the way he was in that classroom. For example, I'll listen to economists on your show who are from the right, and then Paul Krugman comes along, equally as bright, a Nobel Prize winner. And I enjoy the going back and forth from the both perspectives, or ones in between, or some way out in left field. That's the pleasure, is hearing those points of view. The other thing that the main thing that I wanted to say, though, is that there's been a concerted effort by the right to call everything liberal and socialist. And their intent is, they started with the media, and what they've done is they paralyzed the media with being in the center and only presenting two people, one from the right and one from the left, and there's no reporting of actual facts. It's just, here, you make a decision. Here's two ideologues. Now you make your decision. Then they attack the universities. They've done the same thing. And now they're in the process of calling in and attacking public radio. And instead of coming across with their point, Kathleen, your topics, they'll accuse you of being liberal and not letting a right, a conservative point of view in. And the reason they're doing this is because I was reading the history of and the philosophy of fascism, and Michael Lee, he's from the university. He got his education from the University of Wisconsin. His name is, let me just see here, Michael Ledeen.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is a fascist, and he says that he is a fascist, and he's the guy that's promoted the fascist ideas in the Bush administration.
Okay,
I think we can.
Right.
I'm best qualified. I don't think Michael Ledeen is a fascist, but I'm not qualified to defend him. But I'm pretty sure that's not true. But I will say this: that what the caller talked about at the start about how this student was engaging with a conservative professor, now he should go take a course from a liberal professor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there aren't enough conservative professors on America's campuses. All three of us agree with that. Now, what we do about that is a difficult question. But one of the things that every college student should experience is getting into a debate with someone of very different views from them, that they know to be smarter than them, and having to deal with that intellectually. And today on America's campuses, liberal students have a harder time going through that. It's an important part of intellectual growth. Conservative students get that with most of their professors. Most professors are moderate or left. Only about 15% are conservative. So I think it is a problem in higher education that we have an overwhelming majority of liberal or moderate.
Why do you think most professors are moderate or left?
Well, there's been a small uptick in it, but it is historically, ever since we've been studying this, it goes back to the 30s. Of all the professions, professors were the most progressive, the most liberal. And I think that the reason now that they're more democratic is first civil rights for blacks, where the Republican Party took a much more conservative position after 1964, and also issues like evolution and creationism. You know, today the modern Republican Party has in it people who don't believe in evolution or who believe that creationism should be taught alongside it. When we surveyed professors, it was very hard to find any of them who thought that creationism was the way to go, even among conservatives. So the Republican Party on gay rights is also out of touch with professors and intellectuals. Now, its campuses are so pro-gay rights that even conservative professors tend to favor that much more than other conservatives. So on these key issues, Republicans and conservatives are losing the less than 1% of America that has a PhD.
And just one follow-up on his comments about the press. How important has the press been, and particularly things like conservative talk radio that tend to, they did some years ago, not as much now, pound on the liberal media establishment, East Coast media establishment, but also they pounded on universities being terribly left-leaning.
Well, the same thing happened during the Spanish-American War. The media really said the Hearst papers, you know, would attack professors as being traitors and not supporting the war. But there is an intensity to it right now that I think it's not a conspiracy like the caller said, but it is a campaign. And as we say in the book, it is an indictment of the American media or of higher education or of both that the most well-known professor in the aftermath of 9/11 was Ward Churchill,
mm-hmm.
a kook, a certifiable kook from the University of Colorado who now has lost his tenure because he's also a plagiarist. And when you think of all the sober, restrained, moderate voices that tried to wrestle with 9/11, but I think the media focused on Ward Churchill because he was so sensationalist. And I think that I would put the fault more with the media.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Kathy from Waupaca, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I went to a small Franciscan liberal arts college in Illinois. I'll shout out to it, Quincy University. Two of my brothers went there also. And I think I got a very fine education there. If there was any bias, you really couldn't tell. And I did have a number of Franciscan priests as teachers. They taught us how to think, not what to think. And I think that should be the ideal of a university education.
Let me ask the caller a question. Do you remember during your 4 years of college if someone came on campus who was a supporter of abortion rights and gave a speech?
You know, I can't say that I did.
Because one of the things we found in our study, or some of us already knew, was that there are some campuses around America where there is very strict speech control and where counter voices are not allowed. And it's not the liberal campuses. Yes, there are sometimes when a speaker is shouted down, but that's the exception. But at some campuses, and I don't know about your school, but say Catholic University, no one is allowed to be honored or speak at an event who is a public supporter of abortion rights.
And actually, we weren't a big enough school to really get any big-name people. It was only about 1,800 students, a very small school.
Uh-huh.
So we never got any national big names. We just didn't have that kind of pull, basically.
Well, I certainly don't want to also be seen as attacking Catholic universities either. I got my PhD at a great Catholic school, Georgetown. But I do want to say that there are, you know, people listening today who have applied for jobs outside of higher education have never gone through what I went through when I was first on the job market. I had to write statements of faith about what Jesus meant to my scholarship and how my faith affected my teaching at some schools like Providence College where I was applying. And it is legal for schools to discriminate against Jews, to discriminate against atheists, to discriminate against any religion that they disfavor.
Thanks very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the co-author of Closed Minds, Political and Closed Minds, question mark, Politics and Ideology in American Universities. Our guest is Professor Jeremy Mayer, Associate Professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason, and he's also the author of Running on Race, Racial Politics and Presidential Campaigns, 1960 to 2000. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, and let's go to Tom next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen and Jeremy. I would like to suggest that universities are prejudiced against conservatives because they don't offer a salary which is competitive with the business world.
Yes, we looked at that, and, you know, the first year that I was a teacher, a full-time university professor in 1996 in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I made $29,500. And my friends who had done shorter degree programs at law school or MBA were already making high six figures. You know, so there is a real drop-off in compensation. So I think that also helps explain the lack of conservatives in higher education, absolutely.
But you do say at some point in the book that that all deserves further study, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think that there's been some great work done on that by other scholars as well. And the important thing is to know that those people that are ringing the alarm bells and saying your professors are all part of a liberal conspiracy, hey, this is not a new phenomenon. Professors have always been to the left of the American public opinion. And unless something changes radically, in the next 20 years. It'll be that way in 20 years. And that's we are not changing young people's minds to the left in any appreciable degree.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Art is next from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Art.
Hi, good morning. I would like to say that I have noticed the bias in college campuses for a long time toward the left. And one of the things that I think is a good barometer of that is the number of political events that are held on campuses that are for a Democrat candidate, for instance, versus the number of events that you find on the campus for a Republican candidate. Typically, Republican candidates their events, at least here in Wisconsin, have been held off campus somewhere else, whereas Democrat candidates seem to be welcome on campus regularly. And the other thing is that I'm just thinking back to an event that took place probably 10 years ago, and the candidate was Mark Newman. He was a Republican, and he had a meeting. I think he announced his candidacy for state or for the Congress, I think, on the steps of the MATC, Milwaukee Area Technical College. The faculty there organized protests. So the students were all out in force, you know, with the faculty. But the influence that the faculty has on the students might not be, as you say, might not be changing their minds directly. But I think it may be changing their willingness to contribute in the classroom environment because of fear of repercussions with grading.
I think that there is a possibility that some professors out there, and certainly there are anecdotal evidence of grades being affected by students' politics. There are also complaints from left-wing students feeling discriminated against. But I don't think it's a large-scale problem. I think most professors take their job very seriously. As in any profession, there's going to be a few bad apples. On to the caller's first point, though. There is probably, we don't have numbers on this, but I think it's quite likely that Democratic politicians spend more time on college campuses today than do Republicans. It's not because faculty don't allow Republicans to appear. It's just pure politics. You go where your voters are. You go where you're going to find support. Not many Democrats go to the NRA and give speeches. They don't go to those places because there aren't votes there for them. If I'm a Republican strategist and I see the way the youth vote is trending and I see the way faculty vote is trending, I'm not going to go to a college campus very often or very eagerly. That's not where my voters are. I'll go to the NRA. I'll go to some other place where I'll get a warmer welcome.
Thanks to Art for your call. We go next to David from Eau Claire. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks. Just a couple of comments. My opinion, and I'm a college professor myself, but I think it's unfortunate that we look at all these classroom issues from a left-right perspective, and that seems to be the most common way to understand any issue or topic. And it made me think about the global warming issue, where it's really not a left-right issue, it's a science issue. And unfortunately, I think it's really conservatives that have benefited from bringing the political way of looking at things into questions that, in that case, properly, it's a science issue that we should look at the best science and forget about the interest groups that are lining up on each side when we're deciding the validity of that science issue. And I think there's so much cheerleading going on from either side if we just look at all these issues from a left-right perspective and a lot less critical thinking. And
I think the caller has a good point. I think that some of the decline of Republican and conservative support that we find among natural scientists is because of what some have called the Republican war on science. Now, some of those claims are overblown, but it's clear on issues like global warming, like stem cell research, where national Republican figures have questioned the validity of fairly uniform scientific opinion. It does hit natural scientists in the heart. But I disagree with the caller that global warming is not a political issue. Even if we could all agree, hey, it's happening and it's man-made, then we have a massive political debate about what do we do about it? And politics belongs in that debate.
What about, I'm wondering if this is part of how this is translated into a change perhaps in what's taught in classrooms. Not that long ago, I remember doing a lot of interviews with people like Harold Bloom the number of organizations that you cite in your book have a large base of conservative supporters, the National Association of Scholars, who've been promoting a return to traditional courses in Western civilization, courses in American history. What do you make of that, and does that factor into this liberal-conservative instruction?
It certainly does. There is an active debate in which conservatives and some liberals, by the way, believe that the university should return to its core curriculum. And these curricular debates happen all the time in higher education, going back hundreds of years. What should we teach? And conservatives, hence the name conservative, always want to conserve the existing core curriculum, and progressives want to bring about a different and more modern curriculum. And these debates have political overtones today.
David, thanks very much for your call. Mark is next from Ashland. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I'm up here on the Starlight Lake Superior, and I think we might be heading in the wrong direction with this conversation, or at least there's an alternate explanation. Perhaps the correlation is directly between education and liberal views. In other words, perhaps the higher level of education, the more liberal views.
I think you do see a relationship between them, but I wouldn't want to say that it's because the more you know, the more you realize liberals are right. I don't think that's at all true.
Well, I know that's not very politically correct, but it seems, as I remember, the way the figures break down for voting is that people with a lot of money tend to vote Republican, or people with very little education tend to vote Republican, and you know, people with more education or perhaps, more middle-class aspirations, they tend to vote more blue-collar Democrat. And, I'm just thinking we're barking up the wrong tree. I think it's not very politically correct, I know, but I think the correlation is directly between education and liberal views because there's a logical correlation.
I think what I would say is that it's actually not a linear correlation, that the more education you have, the more likely you are to vote Republican up until about college. And then if you go on to postgraduate, and then the support level for the Republican Party drops down. And, of course, you do want to control for income, as the caller mentioned. But there are many, many deeply intelligent conservatives with advanced degrees who put forth sophisticated arguments. It is a misconception to imagine that American conservatism is represented by Sarah Palin. I think that some of the smartest people I know are very conservative, and some of them, by the way, are very disappointed about George Bush.
Thanks, Mark, very much for your call. Let's go to Charles from Madison. Hi, Charles.
I thought I might share some perspective that goes back a ways. I was a freshman at the University of Minnesota during the Cuban Missile Crisis and involved with the Student Peace Union. At the time, we had a demonstration on campus at Kauffman Memorial Union calling for negotiations and a non-military resolution of the conflict. And we were pelted with eggs and toilet paper by people at the time who were very conservative. And at the University of Colorado, we had a booth during World Affairs Week, which was blown up with plastic explosives by a group associated with the Young Americans for Freedom. And so the atmosphere on college campuses isn't always left or progressive. A lot of times there are some very strong, very strident conservative elements as well, which seem to be able to make their perspective known, unfortunately, a lot of times in very unconstructive ways.
Yeah, I think there has been bad behavior by advocates who have passionate views, and they're 19 and 20, and that's as old as universities. It is important to remember that the greatest acts of campus violence in American history occurred by conservative students opposing integration. The riots that took over the universities of Mississippi and several other southern campuses are the single greatest act of violence that we've ever known in American higher education.
Thanks for the call. We have about 45 seconds left. Scott from Green Bay.
Good morning. Just a quick comment. I'm going to use my own perspective. When I was in my 30s, studying economics during graduate work, I had a professor get up. It was November of 1991. I'll remember it clearly. They got up in front of the class and said, if any of you don't vote for Clinton, you're idiots. And it just will always, I mean, I always had a bias towards public universities in general because you can't go to Madison and not feel the culture of capitalism there. And to have a professor stand up in front of impressionable young people, I was an adult that had critical thinking skills abilities, to actually say that, I thought it was so over the top. I can't.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm so sorry that happened to you. If it happened to a classroom where I was a student, I would go right to a dean, and I would say that was inappropriate classroom conduct. And I guarantee you, any good dean would take some action. It might, you know, tenure is not, doesn't mean that you can't be reprimanded, that you can't be embarrassed, and that you can't be told, hey, that's out of line.
And thanks for the call, Scott. We're out of time. Thank you, Professor Mayer, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Professor Jeremy Mayer, our guest, the second half hour, co-author of Closed Minds, Politics and Ideology in American Universities. It has just been published by Brookings. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for your calls and for your interest in this topic. I knew you'd be interested, and indeed you were. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.